Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation entitled Clinical Insights on Dyskinesia and Tremor in Parkinson's Disease. I'm Dr. Daniel Kremens. I'm a professor in the Department of Neurology and co-director of the Movement Disorders Program at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Dr. Fernando Pagan. I'm a professor and vice chairman for the Department of Neurology at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C., and the director of the Movement Disorders Program and the medical director of MedStar Georgetown's National Parkinson's Foundation Center of Excellence.
Managing Parkinson's disease presents many clinical challenges, particularly when it comes to distinguishing between similar appearing motor symptoms. Dyskinesia and tremor are frequently confused, yet each requires a distinct treatment approach. In today's discussion, we'll explore how to accurately recognize, differentiate, and manage these key features of Parkinson's disease motor fluctuations. Joining me in this conversation is Dr. Yasar Torrishyaghi. Dr. Torrishyaghi is an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology and the director of the Parkinsonism and Dementia Clinic at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining me and Dr. Pagan this morning. Let's begin. So, Dr. Yaghi, what are the key features of dyskinesia and tremor observed in patients with Parkinson's disease? And what are some misconceptions among patients and even clinicians when it comes to distinguishing between dyskinesia and tremor?
Thank you, Dan, for asking that question. You know, the topic of today's discussion is a very important one. In a movement disorder center like all of ours, we have to oftentimes distinguish between what is a dyskinesia and what is tremor. And in the days prior to virtual visits, and in the days where we would use phone calls to differentiate between, are you dyskinetic as a patient, or are you experiencing tremor? Sometimes we'd really have to get into the details about what might be happening, because determining whether or not something's a dyskinesia versus a tremor can really help guide our treatment algorithm. Should we increase our medications, decrease our medications, change the frequency of our carbidopa/levodopa administration, or consider using adjunctive agents that may help mitigate or reduce dyskinesias? So determining whether or not someone's dyskinetic or tremulous is important. The key features of a dyskinesia, when we think about them in clinical practice for Parkinson's disease, are really thinking about and determining whether or not a patient might be having an uncontrollable, excessive movement of any part of the body. It can be in the head, the neck, the torso, the limbs, or even orolingual, and determining whether or not the dyskinesias are occurring and where they're occurring can be very, very helpful in distinguishing it from tremor. Now, we think about dyskinesia as a choreiform movement in many cases, and chorea comes from the Greek word to dance. And so oftentimes when we are trying to determine whether or not a patient is experiencing dyskinesia, we may ask them, are you having kind of writhing or uncontrollable movements that might be dance-like and hard to control?
Thank you so much, Dr. Torres-Yaghi. Thank you for explaining the difficulties of the language that we use, tremor versus dyskinesia, and how it's so important to teach patients what a tremor is and what a dyskinesia is. And I do agree with you that the use of virtual visits can be very beneficial, because we would get these phone calls where we would be told, "I'm having more tremor." We go up on the levodopa, and then they had even more dyskinesia. There are definitely challenges in making sure that the patient and the physician are talking the same language and explaining the same thing. So the terminology is very important. Can you share with us why people develop dyskinesias? What's the underlying mechanisms of developing? What are the factors that people will develop dyskinesias, and are there risk factors as well for developing dyskinesias? Are there certain patients where we see dyskinesias more likely? So please share with us when and why dyskinesias develop in Parkinson's patients, and then maybe some of the pathophysiology behind it, but also the risk factors. That who are the patients that are most vulnerable to this?
This is also an important question to be able to answer. When we are taking care of patients in big centers focused on movement disorders, when we think about dyskinesias, we have to educate our patients, as you mentioned, Dr. Pagan, and we have to talk specifically about the natural progression of our condition, right? So the natural progression of Parkinson's disease within the context of the narrowing therapeutic window is kind of the basis of how we may describe, why and when a dyskinesia may be more prominent in a patient. There are some demographic factors also sometimes in female patients that have a lower body mass index. We may consider them to be more at risk to develop dyskinesias with carbidopa-levodopa therapy, potentially earlier on in the natural progression. So there's a lot of different kind of factors when discussing when and when to consider thinking about dyskinesias. In clinical practice, we do tend to evaluate patients for motor fluctuations early on in the disease state as well. If someone is on carbidopa-levodopa therapy, it's important always to screen for motor fluctuations, not just think about off time, but also screen for dyskinesias, whether or not they're troublesome or non-troublesome, where they might be in the body. Especially nowadays, we have different treatment solutions for dyskinesias. It's important to address them and understand them. As to why it happens, we have to recognize that over time, we continue to lose our dopaminergic neurons, and we also need more and more carbidopa-levodopa therapy as motor fluctuations progress in the natural progression of Parkinson's disease. And so when we talk about initiation of carbidopa-levodopa therapy over many years, for example, we might also tell patients we have to watch out for dyskinesias that might happen at peak dose within an hour or so of taking carbidopa-levodopa, but can also happen in a biphasic manner at wearing off as well.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot that goes into the notion of also pulsatile stimulation, right? So, unfortunately, until very recently, the main way we could deliver these medications is orally. It's a very inefficient way to deliver the medicines, and particularly with the early instant release formulations, you'd have this sudden surge of levodopa into the brain. And initially, you have enough presynaptic neurons that you can reuptake and store the dopamine. But with time, we lose these presynaptic neurons and we become much more dependent on the short half-life of levodopa, resulting in this very pulsatile stimulation. The postsynaptic receptors start getting slammed by the dopamine. I think there's a thought that there's some remodeling and some as a result of this pulsatile stimulation, that you get misfiring and that leads to the dyskinesia. I think one other really important risk factor when we think about, I totally agree, women and low body weight, but I think in my practice, probably the biggest risk factor is young onset. So young onset patients, almost all of them will develop dyskinesia and they're going to develop it relatively early. Another thing that I think we have to keep in mind that we learned from the L-DOPA study, because I think a lot of people think of dyskinesia sort of as a very late thing in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, but it actually can happen early depending on how we're dosing the levodopa. So we know that patients in the L-DOPA study who were receiving 600 milligrams by 42 weeks, 17% of them, and these were young, but these were early patients, had developed dyskinesia. In STRIDE PD, we also saw that in patients who were receiving between 400 and 600 milligrams of levodopa, they were also much more likely to develop motor fluctuations and dyskinesia. So I don't know that there's anything magical about 400 milligrams of levodopa as the daily dose. And ultimately, the vast majority of patients are going to require more than that. But it really does seem that that is sort of a threshold point for a lot of patients where the risk of dyskinesia really seems to go up. So, I don't know, do you have anything additional with that point,
No,
Fernando?
I agree with everything that you said. I think that's really important. The 400 to 600, the people above 600, where we learned in the L-DOPA and the STRIDE PD study. The biggest risk factor is really off. If you have offs, that means the levels are going in a pulsatile fashion. And if we take a look at all the new advanced therapies, and well, I'm sure we're going to go into them as we have more advanced therapies that reduce off, we always have more on time with less troublesome dyskinesias with all the newer advanced therapies as we're moving forward in getting better ways to deliver our dopaminergic therapies. So we see this, and I agree with you, the young onset, low body weight, especially females, you can start a half a tablet 3 times a day or half a tablet 4 times a day. So you're not even at 200 milligrams of levodopa. And sometimes you will see a person with dyskinesias. So there are some vulnerable populations. There's some phenotypes of Parkinson's that are a little bit more prone to dyskinesias. Definitely, I think these are really important points, all of both of what both of you mentioned about developing dyskinesias.
So Fernando, you raise a really interesting point there because you're talking about how off is the big risk factor. And for a lot of patients, one sign of off may be tremor. So how common is it, Yasar, to have patients who have both a tremor and dyskinesia, right? And I think this is what you were hinting at in your first response. The difficulty sometimes with patients distinguishing this. Because in my experience, it's very common. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely, and that's kind of what we're all expressing during this discussion is, it's so important to recognize the difference. What is a tremor versus dyskinesia? And it is, as you mentioned, common to hear in a patient with motor fluctuations, with off episodes, to also hear that they may be having, for example, choreiform dyskinesias, maybe an hour or two after their dose of carbidopa levodopa. And which is why the formulation absolutely matters. Thinking about extended release medications, and now in 2025, subcutaneous delivery systems, for example, can help us stay within that therapeutic window. But if we're thinking about, as you mentioned, kind of the pulsatility of carbidopa levodopa immediate release, that threshold, that kind of concentration max, and relying mainly on the pharmacokinetics of our carbidopa levodopa immediate release, oftentimes might get us above that therapeutic threshold into that peak dose dyskinesia. But to answer your question, a few hours later, we might also experience temporally now symptoms of off, and our patients are now having tremor. But at the same time, we have biphasic dyskinesias, which might happen. Kind of an end of dose wearing off dyskinesia also can happen concurrently. Oftentimes, we might see in the same patient at the same time dyskinesia and tremor, and that can be a little bit more challenging, especially in the phone days when we were using the phone, having to kind of listen and really not knowing what to do and what next step to take to be able to kind of address, is it tremor, is it dyskinesia, or is it both? And it's also, I would say, not uncommon in some patients that are prone to motor fluctuations. One part of their body may be experiencing dyskinesia, while another part of their body might be experiencing tremor.
Right. And this leads to the and we'll discuss treatment in just a moment, but this leads to the therapeutic dilemma because anything we do to increase on time is typically going to exacerbate dyskinesia. So we're left in this push me pull you situation a lot of times. Before we move on to treatment, I just want to ask, are there any practical hints you have for our viewers on how they might help their patients distinguish, or how for themselves they might help distinguish dyskinesia versus tremor. You did mention sort of choreiform movements. Do you use one thing that I found very helpful, particularly since COVID and the use of video visits is video visits, or also asking the patient to videotape themselves and send me that. Is that something that you guys have incorporated?
Absolutely. Thank you for mentioning that. The one of the best things we can do when we're seeing a patient in follow-up, for example, and they're trying to describe something, I love it when this happens. The patient or care partner says, "Oh, I got a video of this." And I say, "Perfect. Okay." Because, if a picture is worth a thousand words, a video is worth much more than that for us when describing phenomenology of symptoms. So those are two great tips, Dr. Kremens, that you mentioned, because sometimes it's hard to describe, and the timing also is very, very important. Asking patients to diary their symptoms, when they eat, when they take their medication, and really educating our patients as to what it looks like to have a dyskinesia. Sometimes showing them videos of what a dyskinesia looks like, and then showing them videos of what a tremor might look like, helps them understand kind of the natural course throughout the day. And if we have that timing of carbidopa/levodopa, also when a patient is eating, when their mealtime is, and what they might be eating, because there are certain things that may exacerbate dyskinesias dietarily. So all of those are great tips.
Yeah. Dan, I think this is a really important point. And using their videos, especially if a spouse or family member takes a video of them to show them, because a lot of patients don't realize their dyskinesia. So they don't see it as severe. So they sometimes when they see themselves for the first time, say, "That's me. I didn't know I looked like that." So sometimes the dyskinesia are definitely much more bothersome to a family member, and they are the ones who take the video. But you could use that video to kind of teach the family member and the patient about dyskinesias and tremors, because, and then especially if you see dyskinesia and tremor at the same time, that's probably a wearing off dyskinesia, or it could be where we are biphasic, and that's the reason for changing therapies or going to a more continuous therapy or adding more levodopa if it's mostly wearing off. So getting that information, that video can sometimes be very essential in choosing the next steps in order to help that particular patient. So I think in today's world, everything can be videotaped. This is a really good use of video in our patients. And again, if they don't have a family member, then the virtual visit, hopefully you get to talk to the patient while they're having dyskinesia or the tremor, and that's really going to help distinguish. So movement disorders, we're all about videos. Now in today's world, we can get videos all the time. I remember when I first started in this field, I always had to ca carry around my camera, to videotape everything. Now I have an instant camera right next to my side. Just pull out my phone, and there we are. So,
Yeah, some of us, Fernando, are old enough to remember when we had to film them. So, and I think one of the points that you bring up is that, again, sometimes the patients don't understand the impact that their dyskinesia is having on them. For example, I had a patient who was falling a lot, and she was attributing it to her balance, and her balance certainly was part of it. But really, in her case, what was contributing to it was her dyskinesia. And when I showed her, again, it's as you said, when I showed her the film, she realized, okay, we need to address this. I had tried, but she didn't feel it was a problem. But then she realized, okay, this is why I'm falling. So
Exactly.
I want to shift the conversation now. That's been a great conversation about the risk for dyskinesia and maybe some hints about how we can recognize it. But now that we've recognized it, what can we do to treat it? So what are our treatment options for available for patients to help us manage dyskinesia?
That's a really great question, and it's a timely question now. Movement disorders is an exciting arena when it comes to therapeutics. And what we do when we're teaching our fellows and residents in an academic center is we try and inspire them, inspire the future by teaching them about the different therapies that there are. And so the reason why we need to address whether or not dyskinesias are present or whether or not motor fluctuations and off episodes are impacting our patients' lives is because there are so many different strategies and so many different approaches to kind of create symptom control without exacerbating troublesome dyskinesias. As you mentioned earlier, Dan, we were always in the past, thinking about, what can we do if we encounter off episodes? Well, we can either increase our carbidopa levodopa, or we can add adjunctive medications that might be dopaminergic in nature, that may also increase kind of the overall cumulative effect of dopaminergic stimulation and then exacerbate dyskinesias while at the same time improving off episodes. Now in 2025, with extended release formulations of carbidopa levodopa, that also may help us, especially thinking about the pharmacokinetics of some of these formulations of carbidopa levodopa that create an area under the curve that optimizes the time in an on state, but at the same time kind of moves away from that pulsatile effect that you were also describing in carbidopa levodopa immediate release. That pulsatility really is one of the main reasons why we might see peak dose dyskinesias or dyskinesias. The other options, of course, are utilizing adjunctive therapies, such as amantadine ERDR, because medication like that, it doesn't make you, as a clinician, have to choose between that trade-off of dyskinesia, but yeah, improved off time, but the trade-off is worse dyskinesia, like you would with some adjunctives or increasing carbidopa levodopa. With a medication like amantadine ERDR, what you're doing is you can improve off time while at the same time improving troublesome dyskinesias in patients. So nowadays we don't always have to choose between those two trade-offs. Also, we mentioned a little bit about the subcutaneous delivery systems of phosphorylated levodopa or subcutaneous delivery of apomorphine. What that allows us to do is in a continuous fashion, deliver medications by bypassing the gut, which we know is very much implicated in the motor fluctuations and that kind of decreased GI motility that creates kind of an unpredictability factor of how our medications are working and can create dyskinesias because of the GI dysmotility. What we do is bypass the gut and in a more effective way, allow for the administration of medications to stay within that therapeutic window and also thread the needle, especially in the narrowing therapeutic window that sometimes we see.
Yeah, I think those are all very important. I definitely want to highlight the amantadine delayed release, extended release formulations. This is different from the immediate release amantadine that was available since the 1950s. Has level A evidence for reduction of dyskinesias, improving on time without troublesome dyskinesias, and reducing off. Oftentimes, I talk to my patients, when we talk about all the different treatments for dyskinesia, this is the best oral agent that has clinical research evidence for reducing dyskinesias, improving on time without troublesome dyskinesias, and also reducing the off time. And I think the only other therapy that comes close to this drug is deep brain stimulation, because that's the last thing besides the subcutaneous pumps that you could do as well to treat patients having severe motor fluctuations. The best data out there is actually with DBS, and with DBS you can get up to about 4 hours of on time. With the amantadine ERDR, if you look at the EASE-LID1, EASE-LID2 studies, you're getting to over 3 hours. I think it was like 3.6 hours. So the only thing that really beats that is deep brain stimulation. So a lot of times I'll tell my patients, you're a great candidate for DBS, but we should at least try this newer formulation of amantadine. And a lot of times you'll hear pushback and say, well, I could just use the old-fashioned amantadine. Well, actually, in EASE-LID3, they took patients who were on amantadine immediate release, and they weren't getting the benefits of reduction of dyskinesias and the improvement on time, reduction of off time. But when they switched them over to the extended release, now you saw that same benefit. And there was actually even DBS patients that were having those problems in the EASE-LID3 studies, and then they got better. So these are the conversations that we have to have with our patients, that there's a lot that we could do for patients with to be able to reduce these motor fluctuations. And again, reducing those off times and giving a more continuous dosing makes a huge difference for patients who are having these motor fluctuations. And look at the great tools that we have now. We have long-acting carbidopa-levodopa formulations. So we could talk for hours about all the different studies, how they improve on time without Torsen dyskinesias compared to the immediate-release carbidopa-levodopa of 1975, what we traditionally call Sinemet. So we have better formulations, and when we And then we could use these adjunctive treatments, like you talked with the amantadine extended release, delayed release. And if that's not enough, we could deliver apomorphine continuously, so that could be very helpful to downregulate receptors, and that allows you to reduce other medications, and that can give you more on time without troublesome dyskinesias. And finally, we could use a subcutaneous phospholevodopa formulation to give more continuous. So, and then ultimately DBS, and sometimes we'll go straight to DBS and then come back and use those treatments again. So it's an exciting time, I think, in movement disorders, because we have so many options and we can personalize the options for each patient.
Yeah, I think that's a really important way to think about it, Fernando. This is a very we're in a different age now when we think about the treatment of dyskinesia. I think in the old days, the way to approach it was either to cut back medicines and then the patients worsened motorically, but their dyskinesias did improve, fractionate levodopa, which meant that the patient was taking little half doses of levodopa all day long, which from a compliance standpoint was a nightmare. They could use regular amantadine or generic amantadine, which we had. And there is some data Verhagen published in the late 90s that it could potentially help with dyskinesia, but there's no data that generic amantadine does anything for off time. And as we pointed out, the majority of patients who are having dyskinesia are also experiencing off time. And that's where delayed release, extended release amantadine shines, because it treats both of them. And now we have the continuous the subcutaneous infusions of both phoscarbidopa, phospholevodopa, and subcutaneous apomorphine. So and we know in those studies that they improved off time significantly without worsening troublesome dyskinesias. And what's really exciting in my mind, and unfortunately we don't have these studies yet, is are using these extended oral forms of levodopa that are now available, are initiating continuous subcutaneous infusions early. Are these things actually going to delay or prevent the development of dyskinesias by finally achieving continuous dopaminergic stimulation, which has been the goal? We're not there yet. We don't have those studies, but boy, is it exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting, and that's I think that's really the future, to start these therapies sooner to prevent those fluctuations. Can we prevent the severe motor fluctuations in dyskinesias by starting these therapies a lot sooner for our patients? We always have the gut issues. So we may not ever get there really with some of the oral agents, but maybe with some of these subcutaneous pumps, maybe we could prevent it if we started it earlier in some patients. The other things that we have to keep a lookout is that there is these new generation dopamine agonists that we've seen in clinical research, and there's some even in clinical trials right now that look very impressive, that they mimic the activity of levodopa very well, and they're probably just as potent. I think that's what makes apomorphine such an attractive drug, that it is a potent agent just as good as levodopa, and when given continuously, you see these downregulation receptors. But there are some other dopamine agonists which I kind of termed the second generation dopamine agonist. Maybe it's really the third generation. They're much more selective, and they are don't have the same baggage that previous dopamine agonists had in the past. That you don't see the impulse control disorders or the somnolence associated with it, or some of the other neuropsychiatric features that we're accustomed with dopamine agonists. So I think we have to keep a lookout in the literature for those agents in the future, because not only could they improve on time, but they'll improve on time without troublesome dyskinesias, and they're so potent that you're able to reduce the amount of levodopa a patient is getting, like we do in DBS, or when we use apomorphine pumps, the subcutaneous apomorphine pumps. So that could also reduce dyskinesias. So more research is still needed, but those products are very exciting for us. And again, this is why I think it's really important for clinicians to be aware of all the different products that we have out there to help our patients having severe motor fluctuations. That in today's world, there really should not be, there's nothing more I can do for you, because I think there's so many options for our patient that there is a lot that we could do for patients, and I think there's a lot to offer patients, and it's going to get even more exciting over the next few years as we continue to research some of these new agents and do further clinical trials to really answer those questions that you were posing, Dan. I think it's an exciting time.
Yeah, and just to complete your thought, for our viewers who aren't as up on the development of some of the newer drugs, you're referring to largely the D1 family agonists that are in development right now. They're not FDA approved yet, and they're still
That's
under study.
correct. Yeah, there's a D1, D5, and there's a D1, D2 partial agonist that have been involved in clinical trials. So the D1, D5 is farther along, but the D1, D2 partial agonist is in really early clinical trials, and it looks very promising as well.
Right. And just to be complete, today's discussion has really focused on medical management, but as was mentioned earlier, I think DBS and also now focused ultrasound are surgical or device-aided therapies that one may consider for these patients as well. Dr. Yagi, any final thoughts on as we wrap up our discussion today on the world of tremor and dyskinesia in 2025?
Well, it's been an incredible discussion that I've had with both of you. So thank you for allowing us to have a conversation as important as this one, to be able to understand what is a dyskinesia, what is a tremor, and what impact does knowing the difference have, not just on our patients and family members, but also on our clinical decision making. And so, I guess one advice that I would share with clinicians and also to patients to better identify and manage dyskinesia versus tremor is really screening is so important. And as you both mentioned, dyskinesias and motor fluctuations and off episodes can happen even very early in the disease course. And so keeping our minds open when we're seeing patients and always screening for dyskinesias and wearing off is part of our practice, and how we decide at what point should we alter medications? What do we do? Or when might we consider a continuous delivery subcutaneous therapy versus a more procedural treatment like DBS or MRI-focused ultrasound? When might we think about considering a medication like an extended-release amantadine for a patient that might be experiencing dyskinesias and motor fluctuations? And lastly, I think the concept of good on time is also important. We think about on and off, and as we're describing to patients, reminding them that our goal with treatments is to produce that good on time, and teaching even our patients about what good on time means. It means, we're reducing off time and we're keeping our patients in an on state, essentially without troublesome dyskinesias. And how we do that nowadays is multifaceted and exciting, as you both put it. So thank you very much for moderating this discussion.
So thank you, Dr. Yasir Torjagas, and to my co-host, Dr. Fernando Pagan, for this really robust discussion on dyskinesia. I think the point is identify it and treat it. It's impactful, and we now have so many exciting new effective options with more on the way. So I'd like to thank you for attending our discussion on clinical insights on dyskinesia and tremor in Parkinson's disease.